Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern. The fourth installment of the Twilight film series continues to top box office charts this week. As with its predecessors, public reaction is divided in response to this latest film, Breaking Dawn. Much of the concern aims at the way the story aligns with a socially conservative moral agenda. Those criticisms have been fueled even more by this latest installment, in which the cast of young characters collide with issues such as teen marriage, sex, pregnancy, and the question of abortion. Other high-profile critics, such as author Stephen King, have criticized the stories simply for bad writing. But with so many teenagers, and a few adults as well, avidly following these Twilight storylines, how concerned should we be about the messages contained in this pop culture sensation? Are the books and this latest film a threat to decades of feminist progress, or are the storyline and the fan frenzy simply the continuing lifeblood of a gothic literary tradition that dates back hundreds of years? Our guest today will bring some high-level analysis to the stories, we hope. First with us in studio, Elizabeth Bay Morovitz is an assistant professor of communication at the University of Missouri. She is one of three co-authors of the book Bitten by Twilight, Youth Culture, Media, and the Vampire Franchise. Her research continues to track the series and its impact on the audience. Welcome back to our program, Elizabeth Bay Morovitz.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you back on the program. Also with us on the program today, Elizabeth Chang is an associate professor of English at the University of Missouri. Her research focuses on the literature and visual culture of 19th century Britain, which includes the Gothic genre. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth Chang.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us as well. We hope that you and our audience will also join our conversation today. Have you seen Breaking Dawn or any of the other Twilight films, or maybe you've read the books? If so, what do you have to say about the storylines and the characters that are in these stories? Share your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start with this question. Elizabeth Bay Morovitz, what is the problem that people are identifying within these stories?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that this Breaking Dawn out of any of the films and the books is perhaps the most controversial. And this is because, I mean, we've had this strong thread. I mean, the interest, really, and you said just a few adults. I would say more than a few adults. So a lot of adult women in addition to teenage girls and boys. But, you know, teenage girls in particular are drawn to this idea of romance. And that's a thread throughout all of the books. But what might be most controversial about Breaking Dawn is this notion about teen marriage, teen pregnancy, and sexuality. And so we see these themes become most prominent in this latest installment of Twilight.
And so what happens in this latest installment mm-hmm. that has people sort of questioning this?
And so for those that are seeing or might go and see the film, they might be surprised there's a little bit less action in this one. And again, really this focus on it begins with Edward and Bella, who are the primary characters in Twilight, getting married immediately post-high school.
Right. Now, Edward's the vampire. Bella
yes.
is the non-vampire
yes, the
heroine.
Human, yes. Yes. The human right. girl in the story. So this romance, kind of star-crossed lovers, if you will, between this you know, this impossible relationship that emerges between this vampire and this teenage girl. So you have first this perhaps somewhat more old-fashioned or conservative notion of certainly waiting to have sex until marriage and getting married quite young. And so you see these discussions that might emerge or these themes that might emerge about teen sexuality and what is the appropriate thing to do and at what time during your at what point during your lifetime is it appropriate to sort of engage in these things in marriage and issues related to sexuality? Now, so that's where the story starts,
right,
really.
Right. Now, Elizabeth, how does all of this sit with the hundreds of years of vampire stories that have come before it? Or at least some of them, maybe. I mean, not a whole history of the vampire genre, but your research looks at some of the classic vampire stories from the Victorian era. Mm-hmm. How does this sit with what was going on around those stories at the time?
Well, yeah, so let me start by just saying that the tradition of vampire literature is so huge. I mean, there's no way that we can talk about all the international incarnations of ways that people have thought about the vampire. So focus on certain incarnations of vampire within certain cultural settings, 19th century British literature, 20th century, 21st century American culture. And in many ways, Edward is diametrically opposed to the kind of vampire that we have in Dracula, which you're going to take as a classic Victorian vampire novel, because he's young, he's attractive, he's frozen in youth, whereas Dracula in Bram Stoker's version is a kind of terrifying elderly foreign gentleman and not really someone who you want to marry and go to an island off of Brazil with.
The honeymoon location in this latest film, right?
So there are a lot of differences there, but I do think one thing that Twilight is working really hard with, which I think is also something that Dracula's very concerned, is the notion of families, how are families put together and who contributes to a family, who can be a part of a family. And obviously, vampires aren't a part of the family in Bram Stoker's version, but in many ways, the kinds of questions about how reproduction happens and shared family values can be passed on to the next generation is a question that both Bram Stoker's Dracula and Stephanie Meyer's book and the adaptation mm-hmm. in the movie are dealing with very much.
And Lissa, in your research, you look a lot at what effects this has on the audience, right? Mm-hmm. What are people taking away from these stories? Is there concern there to be had?
Certainly, and I think that's something that's really important in the intro, which I think is a really good question to think about what effects these messages might have on teens, if we want to talk about teens in particular. But teens are also constructing unique interpretations and meanings from these. And so we interviewed and surveyed a number of teen Twilight fans and found that on the one hand, they really do prefer this romance. So this idea of family that's communicated and this idea of love that's communicated through Edward and Bella, that's the primary relationship that teen girls are identifying with and that adult women, for that matter, are desiring and identifying with. But they're also resisting. So they're not making – we didn't hear from teens that, yes, I want to get married after high school, or yes, I want to have a baby right away. So it's not that they necessarily want to have the same choices as Bella, although they really identify with the relationship that Edward and Bella have. So I think that's an important distinction
right.
to make when thinking about the potential effects of Twilight.
And is that relationship one that girls should be emulating? I mean, a lot of it, he makes a lot of the decisions, mm-hmm. and she has a lot of drama around that. I mean, is that really a good model for people to be following?
And that's what I think is really interesting to talk about and think about. It's the subtleties of what's communicated, I think, about gender and romance here. And so Edward really does make the decisions. So decisions about Bella's sexuality, decisions about marriage. He tries to make a decision about having the child as well, these family decisions. So he, and being a vampire, naturally has physical strength and abilities that are dominant over Bella as well. So he really is both physically and sort of relationally in the seat of power. And so that's a very traditional idea as well, that he's kind of making the call in terms of where their relationship's going to go.
Right. For those of you listening or watching our program, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the latest in the Twilight film series and its place amid the long history of vampire morality tales. My guests in the studio are Elizabeth Bain Morovitz, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Missouri, and Elizabeth Chang, who is an associate professor of English at the University of Missouri. For those of you in our audience, are you a fan of vampire stories? If so, why do you think vampires continue to capture our imagination, and what do you think they can and should be teaching us? Share your thoughts. You can give us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I'd also like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can join our online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Some of what's going on troubles people is that how does that fit with literature in general? I mean, when we get these popular things, I mean, there's a whole history that this fits into as well, right?
Yeah, well, if we're going to talk, make that kind of connection, I think the Victorian novel that we would clearly link, especially some of the earlier installments of the book, to is Jane Eyre, because there's this sort of violent groom who has a dark secret that he's keeping from his very young potential bride. I'm just recapping the plot of Jane Eyre in case that's...
Yeah, but it's almost Twilight-esque as well. It's a good comparison, yeah.
Right, and so, I mean, for me it's not an interesting question to ask, like, should we be concerned this is setting a bad precedent for people who might want to marry a man who has a second wife in the attic? I mean, what's more interesting to us is how is this presenting a set of constraints, emotional, moral constraints on a developing girl's identity, and what, how does it play out? How does it hypothetically play out in that situation? So Jane Eyre tracks with Twilight only to a certain extent, however, because that novel ends with a marriage. Reader, I married him, and Twilight goes on. The Twilight series goes on beyond the marriage to explore what happens after, which I think is actually very interesting, but equally perhaps not easily available to our kind of mimetic questioning, like, should I do what I see in the book? I mean, that's not really a satisfactory question for us to be asking, I think.
But what about the differences in what the audience brings to it? Because, you know, in the era of Jane Eyre, women were in a much different place from where they are now. So Jane Eyre actually represents quite a strong female character in a time when women were not allowed to have that sort of strength within the societal structures. Now we've got Twilight, which is in an era of sort of post-feminist era, and yet we have this woman, this central character who is sort of exhibiting a lot of pre-feminist behaviors, right? Or at least what would have been accepted in the male
culture.
What do you
mean by pre-feminist?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's part of the question. But just one of the criticisms of this story is that we're in an era now where the question of female versus male equality is much more settled than it had been 100 years ago. And maybe that's not true, but this is one of the criticisms of this story, is that now we've got a generation of young girls growing up in an era when much more was possible for women to accomplish than it was 100 years ago. And yet we've got this character who is sort of exemplifying a lot of these stereotypes of the former female gender role. And I just, in terms of comparing it, Jane Eyre versus this, I mean, what the audience brings to the story is a lot different now.
Well, I think that this type of question is probably a question that I'm more comfortable with, or that we're used to.
Fair enough. Yeah, you're a communication scholar, so that's probably better.
So I can't, speak to it in terms of Jane Eyre, in terms of that historical comparison. But you're right that a lot of people have really questioned Bella as being... There's been discussion in the media and discussion amongst fans and discussion amongst parents in different groups about whether or not Bella is a feminist character, or if she's an anti-feminist character, and whether the series is feminist or anti-feminist. And I don't think that there's one right or wrong answer. I think that, you know, different points of the series could be read in different ways. But I do think it's something that's really interesting to consider. So today, where we have seen this progression, right? So we've seen this progression in terms of, you know, women's rights and the variety of women's roles in society, where we see Bella choose the role of, you know, a young bride. We see Bella choose the role of a young mother. We see Bella choose her romance over, you know, her potential college plans and career plans. We see Bella choose this romance with Edward to the extent where she has to cut ties with her biological family. So it's these types of choices that Bella makes where the author, Stephanie Meyer, says, you know, well, this is just, it's a fictional world. This is just Bella making these choices. I'm not saying that these are the right choices, but certainly those choices communicate something. And so I think it's interesting to look at what that might be reflecting about this moment in time, that people identify with those choices or that identify with that romance. And it's also interesting to think about what people might be taking away from that, particularly people that have maybe less experience with romance, like teen girls, in the real world.
Right. Now, you've done some audience research as well. And what sort of things are you finding that people are taking away from from these films?
Yeah, so we did a large scale survey study and some follow-up interviews, so kind of focus groups. And so we had about 5,000 Twilight fans respond to the survey. A smaller subset of that was teens, so just a few hundred that were teens. And we saw with the teens that we asked them, you know, so who are you identifying with? What characters are you identifying with in these books and in the films? And what romance would you most like to have? So we saw that only about 20 or 30% of the teens we surveyed were actually in a relationship. So most of them, you know, didn't really have boyfriends. These were all female fans.
Right.
And so most of them did, I think about 50% identified the Edward Bella as a relationship they would like to have. And those teens that identified that relationship also were more likely to report desiring a boyfriend or a future partner with the same characteristics as Edward. So someone who will protect me from physical harm, someone who, you know, will open the door for me. It's kind of these traditional, I mean, Edward is, how old is he? 107, 109?
1901 was
one. Yeah. So he's, you know, he has this kind of more old-fashioned, naturally due to the time, he has more old-fashioned sort of notion about, I think, gender roles and romance. And so we did find that teens that desired that relationship were more likely to report that they wanted a partner that was like Edward in those very traditional ways.
Interesting. And Elizabeth, what was your reaction to these stories as a literary scholar?
Well, first of all, I mean, I can't help but be interested in anything that so many people are reading, right? I mean, for someone who's interested in reading, I want to know why, and I don't have any answers to that. But I'm also interested in the ways that a vampire continues to be a really persistent fantasy fiction for us, really seamlessly moving through from the early 19th century to today. And so I'm interested in them for that reason, and because they have also, I also think they're interesting because they've engendered so much controversy about people who feel like this is a betrayal of what vampires should be. I mean, that Edward is too soft, and even though we're talking about him right now as if he's a controlling kind of patriarch, within the world of imaginary vampires, let me stress imaginary, he's really kind of a Milky Toast example, right? He's not killing any humans. He's not a really bad guy. I mean,
yeah.
So
he's constantly protective of Bella as opposed to
scary. I think it's interesting too that Twilight, Nina Auerbach, who has a great book about vampires called Our Vampires Ourselves, her thesis in part is that every age has the vampire that it deserves or that it wants. And I think that what's kind of carried along with people's disappointment in the Twilight book is the sense of, like, man, what kind of age am I living in? And this is the, like, weak vampire that I got. You know, like, I didn't get, like, cool Dracula who wants to rule London. I got, like, this guy who's, like, I'm going to live in the Olympic Peninsula with my human girlfriend. And so there's a sense that it's just sort of, there's not enough of a grandiose narrative, maybe. So I think
quite
that's
funny
interesting.
That the vampire our era has created as a high school student in the middle of nowhere.
Well, I think ultimately it's a romance. So it's a classic love story more than a vampire story, really, than anything. And so you see a lot of similarities maybe between, well, and even Stephanie Meyer that sort of loosely models each book after a classic novel, like Romeo and Juliet. So you see, to me, it's really about the romance. I'm drawn naturally to fantasy stories. Mm-hmm. I like the fantasy elements, but more than being even about fantasy, I think we're seeing these parallels with these classic love stories that have been so popular over time.
Interesting. I want to come back to that idea, but first I need to remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the latest in the Twilight film series and its place amid the long history of vampire tales. In the studio with me are Elizabeth Bame Morovitz, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Missouri, and Elizabeth Chang, an associate professor of English at the University of Missouri. For those of you in our audience, another question that we're going to get to at some point, if you're a parent of a teenager, What sort of conversations have you and your child had about the Twilight series? We're going to come back to that conversation pretty soon as we get there. But if you are one of those parents, share your experience. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Before we get on to the parenting question, I want to follow up on this question of romance versus vampire story. How separate are those two things? Aren't a lot of the vampire stories romance tales at their core?
Right, because one of the things that interests us in the vampires and metaphor is the sexuality, and so therefore this romance, sexual attraction connection is always a part of it. I mean, the vampire's maybe not necessarily a romantic object, but it's always a sexual object.
Right, and let's talk about that in terms of the latest film. I mean, the messages around the sexuality in this latest film are part of what's causing the controversy, right? And can you talk a little bit about what's problematic about what's going on in this film?
Yeah, and a part of that, again, is layering this vampire narrative onto the love narrative. So there's inherent danger posed to Bella in terms of sort of engaging with Edward romantically. And so I was very curious to see whether this would relay from the book to the film. And it did somewhat. Elizabeth, you can let me know what you thought about this. But Bella's life quite literally is threatened by her sexual encounters with her now husband, Edward. So due to his vampire strength and her human status. And so we see Bella's body bruised and she becomes pregnant immediately on the honeymoon, and this experience nearly kills her as well. So there's this theme of death being associated with sexuality and with sex that I think is quite interesting and maybe controversial, particularly for a teen audience, where you have this layer of this this danger and this death that could occur as a result.
I would agree that was, for me, the most disturbing part of the movie. And it's a movie, I mean, I don't know what we're doing with spoilers here, but I mean, I was
like, try not to spoil it for the few people who may not have seen it yet that want to.
The ending part of the movie has a lot of blood and guts and is a classic horror, but that was not as shocking to me as the earlier part in which Bella, it reveals that she's bruised and hurt as a result of having sex with Edward, and then, but she, instead of saying, you know, this isn't great, she instead says, no, this is something that I want. I'm fine. I want to keep going. And in fact, the movie, I think the filmmakers are almost not sure what to do, like sort of horrified by themselves, because they then create this kind of peppy montage with the background music in which she tries to re-seduce Edward to come back and bruise her more with his vampire strength. And it's a very tonally disturbing moment, which echoes the way it's portrayed in the book as well, I think. And that, I don't know if you're ready to move the parenting part piece yet, but that would be
a almost there, right?
That would be a piece that would be hard to explain to a teenage child. Like, you're physically injured by this activity, and you should continue to ask for it, and in fact, beg for it. I mean, she's really almost humiliated by him in the scene. So I think that's certainly something worthy of discussion.
Yeah.
And so what is a teen supposed to take away from this? I mean, or how is a teen supposed to interpret what's going on in these stories? I mean, because these are clearly teenage books and movies, right?
And I think that's something that's important. So as conservative as some of these messages are about waiting to have sex until you're married and kind of traditional messages, it's a very provocative and sexual story. Mm-hmm. So it's very sexually intense, even though there is no sexual activity that occurs until post-marriage. And so that's one thing that I think parents should be aware of, is how sexual in nature the relationship really is, even prior to engaging in the relations on the honeymoon. And I think it's important for parents to kind of use that. I mean, we all come to the table with different values, with different beliefs. And so it's not about what you believe in particular, something is whether you align with that story or not, but using it as a point of conversation that maybe this isn't the healthiest relationship or, the most realistic relationship, romantic relationship that the teen is likely to encounter. So sort of just asking teens what they, and again, I don't know if you want to go there yet, but, you know, sort of asking teens what they think about this and asking, well, how did you feel when you saw that scene in the movie? Or what did you think about that? And using that as a conversation starter, where then you as a parent can help sort of guide guide the discussion in terms of your own family values and beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to hear what our audience's experience with this has been. So if you would like to join our conversation and share what your experience has been with this in terms of your own children, if you have teenagers who have watched or read these stories, give us a call, 573-882-8925 is our phone number. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. How does this fit with some of the older stories like Dracula? I mean, there's also sort of a scary, violent undertone to mm-hmm. a classic like Dracula as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it a fair comparison to put these two together, or is this going in such a different place?
Well, I mean, it's a fair comparison that they're both immensely popular works about vampires. So we're inevitably going to make that comparison, even if their substance is very different.
Right.
And so... Are you asking what's the gist of the connection between the two, or does Dracula contain horrific elements?
Yeah, are the previous vampire stories nearly as problematic in terms of what the audience would walk away with?
Well, I guess it depends. That depends on how you understand that the audience takes to walk away with.
Well, what are some of the problems in the previous stories, I guess, compared with what we're dealing with here? So this sort of questionable representation of the sexuality between these two is one of the driving things of the criticism of this story.
Mm-hmm.
In previous vampire stories, what are some of the more problematic elements of those previous stories?
Well, traditionally people object to vampire stories because of the deviance that's on. Like, vampirism stands in for other kinds of sexual deviance. Homosexuality is understood to be things that are understood to be non-normative sexual behaviors. And something that was contemporarily very shocking in Dracula was the heroine's friend, Lucy, is killed off somewhat early in the novel by Dracula, and previous to that, she's expressed a desire to marry three men at once. She becomes very kind of sexually wanton in the way that you're allowed to be in a Victorian novel, which is not that much, but is a lot is implied. And it ends with an incredibly... symbolically suggestive scene of three men together staking her in the heart while her fiancé takes part in it. And it seems to be, it's often read by critics as a rape scene of this dead, excessively sexual girl. And so in the criticism has become an area in which there's a lot of room for analysis. I don't think literary critics are often talking to each other about things that they're worried about them taking away from and being negatively affected by, but it's an area of debate, let's say.
Fair enough. What about the teens? I mean, how are teens responding to these things?
I think in a very mixed way. So there's definitely not sort of this uniform effect upon teens or uniform reaction. So we've seen this be kind of mixed. We've interviewed some teen Twilight fans who really respond to the messages of abstinence, for example, in the Edward Bella relationship that really so strongly desire finding someone like Edward that really just identifies. We also had some teen fans that love the series. They love the series. They love the books. And yet at the same time, they describe Edward as stalkerish or as too controlling. So that they are resisting. I mean, they do recognize some of the potential, what might be read as flaws in his character. But I think overall, what's so interesting about Twilight, which is why we're here, is that people have very strong responses to it. So even and just because someone is a fan doesn't mean that they're a fan of all the messages within the Twilight series necessarily.
Okay. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the latest of the Twilight film series and its place amid the long history of vampire tales. Joining me in the studio are Elizabeth Bain Morovitz, Assistant Professor of Communication at the University of Missouri, and Elizabeth Chang, an Associate Professor of English at the University of Missouri. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back. We hope that you'll stick around. You can join our conversation as well by giving us a call at 573-882-8925, and we'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the latest in the Twilight film series and how it compares with other vampire tales from the past. My guests in the studio are Elizabeth Bay-Morowitz, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Missouri, and Elizabeth Chang, an associate professor of English at the University of Missouri. For those of you in our audience, have you seen Breaking Dawn, the latest of the Twilight films, or perhaps any of the other films? Maybe you've read the books. If so, what kind of message do you think the stories send to the audience? Share your thoughts by giving us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We're also still looking for parents who've talked over these movies with their kids. I'm really curious what sort of conversations have been going on out there around this. So feel free to give us a call with that as well. Over the break, Elizabeth, we were talking about other adaptations of some of these classic literary things and a recent Dracula production.
The Bram Stoker's Dracula, which was Francis Ford Coppola's adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula, starring Gary Oldman and Winona Ryder. I don't know if people remember it or not, but it received a lot of criticism at the time that it came out because it superimposed a kind of destiny romance storyline into what is essentially kind of an invasion narrative. I mean, in the novel, we're frightened of Dracula because he's coming to London to make us his slaves. And the movie made it suddenly, you know, Dracula's searching for his bride who's died and he needs to reclaim her. And I think in many ways that the complaints about that adaptation rehearse some of the ways that people, we've been discussing the ways that people object to the Twilight novels, kind of co-option of the vampire narrative and watering it down, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that there's this double parallel problem where people, some people are feeling it's too much and others feeling it's not enough. So I think that's maybe typical of the ways that people respond to vampires, because that the metaphor is so close to us that it embodies a lot of paradoxes.
Interesting. And one of the other interesting things about this is that it combines the vampire trope with Native American lore, right? I mean, that sort of melding of cultural icons in a way is part of the underpinnings of this whole narrative. How do you think that fits in terms of the public discussion around these books?
I would be very interested to know what your survey respondents had to say about that, because especially in the first movie and books, it's really framed as kind of a contact narrative in the ways that we flash back to the vampires making this treaty with the shapeshifters, and that becomes less important by the time of Breaking Dawn, but it's still operating within a very colonialist kind of paradigm. Even when they go to this Brazilian island, there's still a native informant there who has knowledge of vampires, who's able to kind of treat Bella when she's pregnant. And so this intersection between the European vampires and the kind of indigenous residents that who they come in contact to, who push back against them, is kind of globalized for Stephanie Meyer. And so anyway, did people say things about
No. Well, we say things. I mean, this is a thread of analysis that we're interested in, but not, I don't think, not surprisingly. I mean, race and ethnicity is not something that a lot in our predominantly white sample, not something that they had really considered or thought about. And probably most people are familiar with Team Jacob and versus Team Edward, and there was very little sort of recognition of the characterization of the Native American characters in terms of being wolves and much more. And we see this again in Breaking Dawn. Well, if you haven't seen part two, spoiler there. But so we see more of this again with sort of indigenous peoples being portrayed in more primitive and animalistic, to the descriptions of the characters in the books, and we'll see how this plays out in Breaking Dawn Part 2.
That's the film that's coming out next November, right?
So the book was split into two films, and so it's very kind of stereotypical in terms of how we've seen that aligns with how we've seen Native Americans portrayed in other films and in other television shows and things from the past, even thinking about Westerns or you know, those sorts of things. But it's not something that we heard fans talk about or really recognize in any way.
Right. Go ahead,
Elizabeth. I was just going to add briefly, it's maybe worth noting that the films, with one exception, have been released right around Thanksgiving also, so that it's intersecting that night.
It was interesting in terms of the context of Dracula that you brought up, that, you know, the cultural context around Dracula was this sort of invasion from the east, sort of exotic oriental invasion from the east. And now we've got this vampire story that harkens back to a sort of social contract where we've all agreed to get along with each other, right? In a world that is much more multicultural than what was going on at the time of Dracula. Mm-hmm. Do you think that may have something to do with why that sort of trope within the story plays with audiences and seems logical that that would make sense, that vampires and werewolves would all be coexisting?
I think since Dracula, there's been a huge amount of sort of exploration of the way that the vampire intersects with ideas about race. So, for example, the Blade films, which star Wesley Snipes as a black vampire, and also Octavia Butler's great vampire novel Fledgling, which is about a black vampire struggling to gain acceptance within a kind of European vampire world. And so I think that the as a vampire becomes owned by the 20th century American culture, it just becomes something that is forced to integrate with identity politics as we understand them in a different way.
And I think it's important to note in terms of the Twilight series, if you look at the contrast between the Cullens, the vampire family, so Edward's family, and the Native Americans, who they're sort of in struggle with and in terms of very sort of naturally at war with in the series, the Cullens are ultimately like the most sophisticated, high culture, associated with wealth and whiteness and privilege. And then you have the Native Americans that are in stark contrast to the Cullens. And that's different from, I think, issues of race and vampires that we've seen in previous vampire stories. So I think that's something that's unique here and is very comfortable probably for most readers because it's something that we see pretty traditionally, as I said, with Native American representations in mainstream U.S. media. So we're seeing that here. So we have the Cullens, if you look at them even beyond being vampires, because they don't act like vampires like we see in previous texts, is really being this idealistic sort of upper class white family that's in contrast to this Native American culture.
Right. There's the class fantasy that's very layered over. And that's coming with the romance plot.
Yeah.
Talk more about that, the class fantasy that's contained in these stories.
Bella is marrying up when she marries Edward, right? I mean, they're leaving Brazil, and he's able to hire a private jet, or
the island is owned by the family.
So it's Cinderella suddenly, right?
It is, and she's very entranced by that world. In the books, even more so than the movies, there's a very lavish description of the kinds of expensive automobiles that he buys her. Mm-hmm. And
although she's uncomfortable with
it. She's uncomfortable with it, but she takes it. She becomes comfortable with it. So
We have a question from the chat room, which I think is a pretty good question. At what age is it appropriate for kids to start reading these books?
I don't know if there's an exact age, but I'll put my opinion out there. So this is just my opinion. I don't think that preteens should necessarily. I know I've heard of many 10 and 11 year olds that have been reading these books. I tend to think that that's a bit young just due to the sexual nature of the relationship, even though, again, they're not. It's very heady romance throughout the books. And we did interview a couple of 10 and 11 year olds, actually, some with their parents who also read the books. And so certainly younger girls are reading these books, but I think it's more appropriate. It's a young adult fiction. It's categorized not in the children's literature, but young adult literature. And so that's geared really more towards teens, so kind of 13 and up, right?
Yeah. I
don't know what the exact distinction of young adult literature is.
Fair enough. Well, again,
young adult literature,
if that's 13,
Again, to any parents listening, if you have kids and have gone through this, we'd love to hear your expertise on this in terms of the appropriate age at which Twilight might be introduced to kids. You can give us a call. Our number is 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org, or you can go to our website, kbia.org, follow the link for Intersection, and you will land on our live online chat. You can communicate with others in the audience and with us as well through that. In terms of some of the social issues that came up, I mentioned in the introduction, abortion comes up in this as a social issue. Is there a way to talk about that without giving away the storyline here?
I think we're beyond spoilers. Okay. I think the spoilers are already happening here.
Well, let's talk about how. Let's talk about how this story deals with abortion and what people might find contentious about that.
Well, an abortion is never explicitly mentioned in the series nor in the book, but we have the situation of this this teenage girl who becomes married and becomes pregnant with a vampire baby, of all things. That's the spoiler part here.
Yeah. It's unknown, yeah. Right, right, during the time most of these discussions are taking place.
We know this is not a normal pregnancy.
Bella feels movement immediately after thinking, perhaps my period is late. I think I have something moving. So it's really a very accelerated timeline.
Yes, an accelerated timeline is pregnancy, so decisions are needed to be made quickly. And it becomes clear quite quickly, and this is where the controversy comes in, becomes clear quite quickly that Bella's life is in danger. And we learn from this woman in Brazil that this is not going to end well, so that death is imminent if she continues to carry this baby. There's no way for her to survive as a human to survive this pregnancy. And she chooses to go forward without considering alternatives of maybe saving her own life over the child's life.
Now, that alternative is raised in the narrative, right? I mean, somebody suggests
this can be a key proponent of it. Mm-hmm. So he said, well, we'll get this out of you,
right?
I think. And some of the vampires, other members of the Cullen family, are also of that opinion. Jacob is of that opinion, and others are not. So it's sort of stages of debate, although it's obviously stacked in favor of Bella, whose suffering is really the focal point of that book and movie.
Yeah, so Bella herself never considers it, but Edward is, and they never talk about it explicitly in terms of being abortion, but again... Yeah.
Well, it's not exact. I mean, it's not like she's headed down to a clinic.
Right. Yeah, it's an unusual situation, unusual pregnancy.
Right. And Edward's father's a doctor, right? I
mean, he has an at-home clinic, which is convenient, luckily.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
That's always helpful in moving the story along. But part of it, too, is a linguistic, semantic thing as well, right? I mean, in terms of how they refer to what is growing inside of Bella. Isn't that a contentious point?
They argue that, right? They say some call it a fetus, some call it a thing, some call it a baby.
And in the film, if you've gone out and seen Breaking Dawn, I mean, this becomes a point of contention between Edward and Bella quite early in setting the stage for the discussion around the pregnancy is, let's get it out of you. And she automatically reacts against that sort of language that's being used. So she feels that immediate connection with the baby and...
Right. So it sort of mirrors a social dialogue going on in politics, right?
Which there's is what no I think way. Is so interesting.
Yeah, there's no way to avoid assuming that, I think.
Yeah.
Right. And therein sort of lies the question about whether this film is appropriate for teenagers in terms of the messaging. Yes? No? I mean...
Well, I don't think that issue... I mean, I think that it's... I mean, there's nothing wrong with discussing those issues, particularly with I think that the teenage audience, it's especially appropriate to be talking about those types of things. And so it's not that it's covered, but I think that there needs to be some awareness, and particularly that Bella so consistently puts herself in danger and in sort of a position of being threatened and being not quite in power of many of the situations in the novel. And so I think that's more what's concerning. I'm not so concerned with some families might be more pro-choice or pro-life, and I'm not sure that that's so much the issue is whether you align with that, but it's that knowing that these messages are in these series, in the series, and talking to your teens about that. So kind of using that as an opportunity.
And is it your sense that teens understand these messages or not?
They do. They do understand. The 10 and 11-year-olds that we interviewed do not. So they're not – they tend to talk about Jacob more and kind of a best friend and align with Seth, some of the younger some of these other aligning with very different things. But some of the teens directly talked about abstinence issues and choices of getting married and having a baby. And they do. I mean, they do recognize these themes, but they have a more limited experience with which to situate this. And so what was interesting, I remember specifically being in a focus group with some older teenagers, so kind of 19, 18-year-olds, and saying, oh, I thought it was really cool. My parents had told me, you know, we should wait to have sex until we're married, but it never really seemed cool until I, you know, fell in love with Edward and Bella and read these books. So, I mean, they're directly linking that to their own sort of sexual experiences and sexuality and their own plan for them, for themselves, but from a very different way. So there are other teens that don't relate to that message of abstinence, but I think that they definitely are reading their own lives and kind of reflecting on their own lives in relation to what's happening in the books and the movies.
Interesting. Elizabeth, your thoughts on that?
I didn't know.
Okay, fair enough. Once again, I'll remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about the latest in the Twilight film series and vampires and morality and teenagers and all of that stuff together. Joining me in the studio are Elizabeth Bay Morovitz, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Missouri, and Elizabeth Chang, an associate professor of English at the University of Missouri. For those of you in our audience, are there films or books from your own teenage years that shaped your own life in some way? If so, share your story. Tell us what that was all about. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Elizabeth Chang, a question for you. Are there other vampire tales that people might not know as much about that might be relevant to our conversation here today?
I already mentioned Octavia Butler's Fledgling, but I would give another plug for it because it's a fascinating book, also about a teenage girl trying to find her way, but under very different circumstances. And for people who are not familiar with Octavia Butler, she's a sadly died too young African-American science fiction writer, one of the few women to win Hugo and the Nebula. And she worked in a variety of genres. Fledgling is her only vampire novel, but her concerns for race, class, and the values of multicultural society are quite different from Stephanie Meyer's, I would say. And so it would be a very interesting counterpoint. So I would recommend that. In many ways, it is as sexually explicit as the Twilight books, but offers perhaps a richer exploration of some of the themes of compulsion and a feeling that you must do something that you don't know if it's good or bad for you. And there's a lot more kind of detailed working through of the consequences of those kinds of choices from the perspective of a teenage girl. So in that sense, it's an interesting parallel. Although they're very different books. I don't want to pull the wool over anyone's eyes.
Are there other things that vampires can teach us about being human? I mean, we've talked about some of these themes here already, but
I think that's the continuing appeal of vampires. I mean, that they're close enough to us, and yet they have the fundamental difference of immortality and of this need for blood. And so I think anytime we start to ask questions about some very fundamental human conditions, free will, our legacy, our own mortality, the purpose and possibilities of our reproduction, we start to tell them using vampires in a way, because they're such an effective vehicle for asking those kinds of really big picture questions. Because it was like, what if we were us, but we didn't die? Or what if we were us, and yet we didn't care if we killed someone? And so I think vampires are endlessly interesting to us for that reason, in a way more so than other kinds of supernatural beings like zombies, or which are just kind of mindless, right?
But what's interesting, they're very popular.
They're popular right now, but I think that vampires are more enduring because of their minds.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about the blood that appeals? I mean, the idea of these vampires consuming human blood, what is that all about?
I think that means different things for different vampire stories, and that's another example of the flexibility of the metaphor. I mean, that it can accommodate a lot of ways of thinking about vitality, the human life force, the soul, nourishment, maternal gifts, all kinds of things like that can be carried through in blood. And you can think of vampire stories that exemplify each of those aspects of it. So I think it could be many things, and that's what's great about it.
Like, can you think of a few stories off the top of your head that sort of come at that blood idea from different ways?
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, The Hunger. Have you seen The Hunger?
Mm-mm.
The Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie film?
Which I haven't seen it either.
Oh, it's great. I'm recommending, like, the most randomly different.
No, this is great. This is great to get exposed to these things.
So this is from the 80s, and it's a film that interacts very closely with AIDS, because this is a time in which HIV was just being discovered, and so blood becomes a metaphor in that way. Then we have something like Buffy, which, I mean, maybe is an interesting predecessor to Twilight, which takes up vampires and the blood as a way of kind of capturing sort of to teenage life, like the perils and promises of being a teenager, in some of the ways as Twilight, but with this added sense of destiny, which Bella doesn't usually operate from. Then how much longer do you want me to keep going?
No, I mean, we can keep going, but it's interesting you brought up Buffy. I mean, mm-hmm. isn't part of the Buffy thing where we saw a transition into vampires as not bad, evil, villain type characters? I mean, aren't there good vampires in Buffy in a way that...
The good vampires in Buffy are all constrained through some kind of magical strength or bonds. It's never not known in Buffy that vampires are bad guys, but there happened to be a case where a couple of vampires are repressing their natural badness to because of various reasons a spell is cast. Or
right, she
like
is
that.
A vampire slayer mm-hmm. after all.
Right,
right, yeah. So they're... right. Interesting. Okay, so I stopped you on Buffy. What are some of the others?
Oh no, I'm on my list. I co-taught a course on vampires, and now I'm trying to go back over the syllabus.
Just while you think of that, it's interesting. One of our producers found that 7 different colleges use Twilight in their course curriculum, and I'm sure there are more than that. But
I'm interested to see how it's being pulled into the academy now, especially into the literature. I mean, I think there's a huge precedent for using it in studying media effects, as Lisa has shown.
An exemplar mm-hmm. case study.
Because it's so dominant. Mm-hmm. Literature departments probably aren't as necessarily eager to integrate into the curriculum. When I was teaching the vampire class, the students openly rebelled when we suggested we might read Twilight. No, this is not literature. We don't want to know about it. We don't want to have to read this. And I think that it's going to be a little bit of a fight to have it included in the curriculum. And I don't know if it should be or if it shouldn't be, but it's certainly...
Well, certainly with the criticisms of the writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How long did it take for novels like Jane Eyre to wind up in a college curriculum?
Well, a long time because of the way that English literature is... The discipline of English is not the way... When Jane Eyre was being written, the discipline of English didn't exist as something that right. we would study. So it's just not a question of, like, can I take this contemporary novel and study at university? At university, you learn things like philosophy and the classics. You would never read contemporary literature in university. So
okay.
it's just...
So not a fair comparison.
Not a fair comparison.
Okay.
But other kinds of contemporary novels are moving fairly quickly into the canon, for good or for ill. We don't know whether... Jonathan Lethem's work is going to stand the test of time against Twilight, and nor is that necessarily an interesting question for us because we don't live in the future, we live right. now. So.
Do you think this stuff will, I mean, I know you just said we don't live in the future, but I mean, is these Twilight books in 2008 were like the best-selling novels mm-hmm. in the country. Do you think that that is going to have anything to do with its longevity in terms of being recognized 20 years from now, being talked about 20 years from now?
I think just from the fan reaction that we've seen that this certainly will have a long life. And so what's really interesting as a communications scholar, we study the ways that fans interact with Twilight. And so there are very active fan communities online. People are going to fan conventions. And so I think we'll continue to see these relationships with the characters. And I don't see Twilight sort of falling off in terms of popularity anytime soon. So even though the series is done, or we think it's done, you never know. She might come out with another novel. But, you know, the series is done, so we see the end in sight with the last movie. But I don't think that when Breaking Dawn Part 2 comes out next November, that's the end of Twilight. I certainly think from the fan reactions we've seen and the types of things people are producing, fan fiction about Twilight, creating art, I mean, all these different types of very active fan communities. So I think we'll continue to see a passion for the story continue.
Interesting. We may have talked about this last time you were on the program, Lisa, but why does fandom of Twilight hold a different place from fandom of something that's also in the surreal nature like Harry Potter or something like that? I mean, the mm-hmm. rabidness of the fan base is fairly similar. The sort mm-hmm. of unrealisticness of the stories are similar. The Hollywoodization of the stories is quite similar. Why is there a difference there?
In terms of how people have characterized the Twilight fandom?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think maybe we did talk about this a little bit. And that's something that's interesting. So Twilight is kind of equally split between male and female fans. And here we see this vampire narrative that is not a traditional vampire mm-hmm. narrative, as Elizabeth has said, and focuses a lot on the romance and is from the perspective of teenage girls. So it's really marketed primarily toward young women.
And so Harry Potter is more divided, is that right?
Yes. So I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. So Harry Potter is much more divided in terms of having a mixed gendered audience, whereas if you look at who's going to the Twilight films, it's very much a female audience. And we see this strong narrative about love that's romance that's so dominant, which I think is a little bit different from Harry Potter. And so I think that we're talking about, I mean, traditionally, female fans haven't been treated with maybe as much respect as male fans. And I think it's this gender divide that we're seeing as this being primarily a female-oriented and driven franchise, which is why we're seeing different responses to something that has more traditional dominant male credibility, like Star Wars or Harry Potter or something like that.
Interesting. And what about the fact that so many adults are reading this as youth fiction? I mean, is that a change, or is that typical that adults read these novels geared toward younger adults?
We saw that with Harry Potter as well, certainly.
That seems like that was the first breakthrough. Are you asking, is that a problem, or
why do you suppose that is, and is that something that's likely to continue in terms of, adults, rather than reading things that are more geared for adults, they're reading these novels that are geared toward a younger
set. Hunger Games is very popular. Mm-hmm. I think we're continuing to see, it really started with, which is children's literature, Harry Potter, it's categorized in the children's section versus these Hunger Games and Twilight and Mortal Instruments or different things that are young adult fiction. But we're definitely seeing, I think, more of a crossover in terms of audiences here. And I think that will continue.
Yeah, and especially, yeah. I mean, these are all supernatural or kind of fantastical young adult fiction. Mm-hmm. I don't think that many adults are reading realist YA fiction in the same kind of numbers. So there's clearly something about the genre
is romance and fantasy in particular.
And it's part of a general explosion in young adult literature that's going on, I think, that driven by these kinds of sales figures for books like Harry Potter and Twilight.
And you have to look at how they're becoming a media franchise. So it's not like you just create a book series, you create the films and you create the products. And so I think drawing audiences into that entire media franchise is very successful.
It's probably not any more surprising than asking why adults read comic books and go to see comic book movies.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Fair enough. Fair enough. That makes sense. Okay, we're going to have to end the program here, unfortunately. This has been a great conversation, and I'd like to thank our guests, Elizabeth Bain Morovitz, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Missouri, and Elizabeth Chang, an associate professor of English at the University of Missouri. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and clicking the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute, and it's a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Roy Mintungikar. Travis McMillan is our technical director. Today, the show is directed by Joe Deutschman. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive producers are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ruben Stern. I'd like to thank you for joining us, and I hope that you'll have a great week. Again, you can go online and watch video of all of our programs. And next week, we hope you'll join our chat online at kbia.org. Take care. Have a great week.